From that moment onwards, Rubashov's recollection of the hearing was rather hazy. Later on, it seemed to him that he had fallen asleep, because the next thing he remembered was the presence of a third person in the room, and Gletkin's voice booming over him. "I beg you to attend to the proceedings. Do you recognize this person?" Rubashov nodded. He had at once recognized Herlip. "When and where have you known him?"
"I've seen him repeatedly from my window, walking in the yard."
"And you have not known him before?"
Herlip stood at the door. The light of the reflector fell full on him. His face was chalky white. His hands hung slackly to his knees. The shadow of a memory passed through Rubashov's mind. The memory of once having seen the living original of this human wreck, long before he had entered cell number 404. "Now that I see him close to, it seems to me that I have met him somewhere already."
"Where?"
"I do not remember."
Gletkin leaned forward, turning towards Herlip. "Will you help Citizen Rubashov's memory a little? Where did you last meet him?"
Herlip's face became, if possible, even whiter. He passed his tongue over his lips and said,
"I was instigated by Citizen Rubashov to destroy the leader of the party by poison."
In the first moment, Rubashov was only surprised by the deep, melodious voice, unexpected from such a pathetic figure. What he actually said, Rubashov seized only a few seconds later. Then he heard Gletkin again. His voice sounded irritated. "I have not yet asked you that. I asked you where you had met Citizen Rubashov last."
"I met Citizen Rubashov after a reception at the trade delegation in Belgium."
While he was speaking, his haunted eyes touched on Rubashov and rested there. Rubashov put on his pince-nez and answered his gaze with sharp curiosity. Gletkin again. "Can you remember the date of the meeting?"
"I remember it distinctly," said Herlip. "It was after the reception given on the 20th anniversary of the revolution."
A memory rose in Rubashov's mind, hastily at first, then more clearly. Now at last he knew who Herlip was. He turned his head to Gletkin and said quietly,
"The date is correct. I did not at first recognize Professor Kiefer's son, as I had only seen him once, before he passed through your hands."
Rubashov thought of his old friend Kiefer, the great historian of the revolution. On the famous photograph of the Congress table, where all wore beards and small numbered circles like halos round their heads, he sat to the old leader's left. He had been his collaborator in matters of history, also his chess partner, and perhaps his sole personal friend. After the death of the old man, Kiefer was commissioned to write his biography. He worked at it for more than 10 years, but it was destined never to be published. The official version of the events of the revolution had gone through a peculiar change in these 10 years, but old Kiefer was stubborn and understood nothing of the inner dialectics of the new era under number one.
"My father and I," Herlip went on our return from the International Ethnographical Congress, made a detour by Belgium, as my father wanted to visit his friend, Citizen Rubashov."
Rubashov listened with a queer mixture of curiosity and melancholy. Old Kiefer had come to see him, led by the need to pour out his heart and also to ask counsel of him.
"In the evening, when the reception at the legation was over, he invited my father to his apartment, and my father allowed me to accompany him. Citizen Rubashov had set out wine, cognac, and cakes on a table, and greeted my father, after embracing him, with these words, 'The farewell party for the last of the Mohicans.'"
"Go on," said Gletkin irritably.
"After a time, My father and Rubashov changed the conversation over to the present. They spoke of the present state of affairs in the party. Rubashov said that since number one sat on the party with his broad posterior, the air underneath was no longer breathable. That was the reason why Rubashov preferred missions abroad.
Gletkin turned to Rubashov. That was shortly before your first declaration of loyalty to the leader of the party, correct?
Correct, said Rubashov.
Was Rubashov's intention to make this great declaration of loyalty discussed during the evening?
Gletkin asked Harelip. Oh, yes. My father reproached Rubashov because of it and said he was disappointed in him. Rubashov laughed and called my father an old fool and a Don Quixote. He said the important thing was to hold out the longest and wait for the hour to strike.
Now, what did he mean by this expression, to wait for the hour?
Rubashov heard the pleasant voice answer. The hour in which the leader of the party would be removed from his post.
How was this to be brought about, pray?
Rubashov declared that number one would never resign from power of his own free will and could only be removed by violence. One could hope for nothing from the party either, for number one held all the threads in his hand and had made the party bureaucracy his accomplice who would stand and fall with him and knew it.
Rubashov no longer remembered the conversation in detail, but did not doubt that Herr Lipp had recounted it faithfully. So Rubashov emphasized the necessity to use violence against number one, that is, against the leader of the party.
Herr Lipp nodded.
And his arguments, which were accompanied by a liberal consumption of alcoholic drinks, made a strong impression on you.
I had drunk practically nothing, but everything which he said made a deep impression on me.
Rubashov bowed his head. Was it possible that this unfortunate youth had in fact drawn conclusions from his, Rubashov's, line of thought? That he stood there before him in the glare of the reflector as the consequence of his, Rubashov's, logic? And following upon this preparatory theorizing came the direct instigation of the deed, Gletkin suggested.
Harelip was silent. Rubashov raised his head but did not speak.
Would you like your memory to be helped out?
Harelip quivered as though struck by a whip. The instigation did not happen that evening, but next morning in a tete-a-tete between Citizen Rubashov and myself. Rubashov turned to Gletkin and asked, blinking in the light. I believe the defendant has the right to ask questions during a confrontation.
You have the right?
Rubashov turned to the young man. As far as I remember, you had just finished your studies at the university when you and your father came to see me.
Harelip nodded.
If I again remember rightly, at that time the intention was that you should start work under your father at the Institute of Historical Research. Did you do that?
Yes, up to my father's arrest.
I understand, said Rubashov. This event made it impossible for you to stay at the Institute, and you had to find some way of earning your living. He paused, turned to Gletkin, and continued. Which proves that at the time of my meeting with this young man, neither he nor I could have foreseen his future job, hence the instigation to murder by poison becomes a logical impossibility. The secretary's pencil came to a sudden standstill. Harelip stared at Gletkin and licked his upper lip. Rubashov had the sensation of having disturbed the smooth running of a solemn ceremony.
Nobody asserted that your instructions restricted the murderer to the use of poison, said Gletkin quietly. You gave the order for assassination. The choice of the means you left to your instrument. He turned to Harelip. Is that right?
Yes, said Harelip, and his voice betrayed a kind of relief.
Rubashov remembered that the accusation had stated in express terms instigation to murder by poison. But the whole thing was suddenly indifferent to him. Whether young Michael Kiefer had really made the crazy attempt or only planned something of this sort, whether the entire confession had been artificially pumped into him or only parts of it, now seemed to Rubashov of merely legal interest. It made no difference to his guilt. The essential point was that this figure of misery represented the consequence of his, Rubashov's, logic made flesh. The roles had been exchanged. It was not Gletkin, but he, Rubashov, who had tried to muddle a clear case by splitting hairs. The accusation, which till now had seemed to him so absurd, in fact merely inserted the missing links into a perfectly logical chain. "Have you any more questions?" asked Gletkin. Rubashov shook his head. "You may go," said Gletkin to Harelip. He pushed a bell. A uniformed warder entered and put handcuffs on young Kiefer. When he was gone, Gletkin said, "Do you now admit that Kiefer's confession accords with the facts in the essential points?" The phrase "in the essential points" did not escape Rubashov. With this phrase, Gletkin bridged over the rent in the accusation and gave himself the possibility of changing instigation to murder by poison into instigation to murder simply.
"In the essential points, yes," Rubashov replied. Gletkin's cuffs creaked, and even the stenographer moved in her chair. Rubashov became aware that he had now spoken the decisive sentence and sealed his confession of guilt. He felt in no state to continue the argument with Gletkin. The consciousness of his complete defeat filled him with a kind of relief. The obligation to continue the fight, the burden of responsibility, were taken from him. The drowsiness returned. From that moment onwards, Rubashov's recollection again became hazy. He had probably fallen asleep for the second time. He must have been woken by Gletkin to sign the statement. Gletkin passed him his fountain pen. The stenographer had ceased writing. There was complete silence in the room. The lamp spread a normal, rather faded light, for dawn appeared already at the window. Rubashov signed. Then, drunk with sleep, he read through the statement in which he confessed to having incited young Kiefer to murder the leader of the party. For a few seconds, he had the feeling that it was all a grotesque misunderstanding. He had an impulse to cross out his signature and to tear up the document. Then everything came back to him again. He rubbed his pince-nez on his sleeve and handed the paper over the desk to Gletkin. And the next thing he could remember was that he was walking through the corridor again, escorted by the uniformed giant. Then he heard the cell door bang behind him and sank down on his bunk with a feeling of physical bliss. He saw the grey morning light on the window panes and fell asleep at once. When his cell door opened again, it was not quite daylight. He could hardly have slept an hour. He thought at first that breakfast was being brought, but outside stood the giant in uniform. And Rubashov understood that he had to return to Gletkin and that the cross-examination would go on. Rubashov's dialogue with Gletkin extended over several days and nights, with short intervals of an hour or two. Grubashov had heard of this method of complete physical crushing of the accused, in which usually two or three examining magistrates relieved each other in turn in a continuous cross-examination. Gletkin's method was that he never had himself relieved and exacted as much from himself as from Grubashov. Thus he deprived Grubashov of his last psychological resort, the moral superiority of the victim. After 5 or 6 days, they arrived at the concluding point in the accusation, the question of the motive for Grubashov's actions. The accusation defined the motive simply as counter-revolutionary mentality and mentioned casually, as if it were self-evident, that he had been in the service of a hostile foreign power. Grubashov fought his last battle against that formulation. The discussion had lasted from dawn to the middle of the morning, when Grubashov, at a quite undramatic moment, slid sideways from his chair and remained lying on the ground, unconscious. When he came to, he saw the little fluff-covered skull of the doctor over him, pouring water on his face out of a bottle and rubbing his temples. The doctor scolded in his shrill voice and advised that Grubashov should be taken into fresh air. The old warder conducted him to the exercise yard. 10 minutes later, he was taken back to Gletkin's room. Gletkin was sitting at his desk in the same position as Grubashov had left him. "I take it you feel better now. We left off at the concluding question, the question of motive. When you have signed that, we will have finished with one another, and then you will be able to rest." Grubashov passed his hand over his temples. "You know my motives as well as I do. You know that I acted neither out of a counter-revolutionary mentality, nor was I in the service of a foreign power. What I thought and what I thought and did according to my own conviction and conscience." Gletkin had pulled a dossier out of his drawer. He pulled out a sheet and read in his monotonous voice, "For us, the question of subjective good faith is of no interest. He who is in the wrong must pay. He who is in the right will be absolved. That was our law." "You wrote those very words in your diary shortly after your arrest." Gletkin had taken another page out of the dossier, but read only one sentence from it. "Honour is to serve without vanity, and unto the last consequence." Grubashov tried to withstand his gaze. "I don't see how it can serve the party that her members have to grovel in the dust before all the world. I have signed everything you wanted me to sign. I have pleaded guilty to having pursued a false and objectively harmful policy. Isn't that enough for you?" "To that, I can only reply with a citation from your own writings. You wrote, 'It is necessary to hammer every sentence into the masses by repetition and simplification. What is presented as right must shine like gold. What is presented as wrong must be black as pitch.'" Gletkin snapped shut the cover of the dossier. He bent forward a bit and settled his cuffs. "Your testimony at the trial will be the last service you can do the party." Grubashov did not answer. He kept his eyes shut and relaxed under the rays of the lamp, but there was no escape from Gletkin's voice. "The party line was sharply defined. Its tactics were determined by the principle that the end justifies the means, all means without exception. In the spirit of this principle, the public prosecutor will demand your life, Citizen Grubashov. Your faction, Citizen Grubashov, is beaten and destroyed. You wanted to split the party, although you must have known that a split in the party meant civil war. You and your friends, Citizen Grubashov, have made a rent in the party. If your repentance is real, you must help us to heal this rent. Your task is simple. You have set it yourself: to gild the right, to blacken the wrong. The policy of the opposition is wrong. Your task is therefore to make the opposition contemptible. To make the masses understand that opposition is a crime and that the leaders of the opposition are criminals. That is the simple language which the masses understand. Comrade Rubashov, I hope that you have understood the task which the party has set you.
It was the first time since their acquaintance that Gletkin called Rubashov comrade. Rubashov raised his head quickly. His chin shook slightly while he was putting on his pince-nez. I understand. Observe, Gletkin went on, that the party holds out to you no prospect of reward. To you, Comrade Rubashov, we propose no bargains and we promise nothing.
I understand.
Gletkin glanced at the dossier. There is a passage in your journal which impressed me. You wrote thus, I have thought and acted as I had to. If I was right, I have nothing to repent of. If wrong, I shall pay.
He looked up from the dossier and looked Rubashov fully in the face.
You were wrong, and you will pay, Comrade Rubashov.
A strange memory came over Rubashov. Where is Ivanov? He asked.
Comrade Ivanov was cynical. He was shot last night in accordance with an administrative decision.
While Gletkin was speaking, he had pushed the prepared statement over to Rubashov and laid his fountain pen beside it. Rubashov signed the statement in which he confessed to having committed his crimes through counter-revolutionary motives and in the service of a foreign power. As he raised his head, his gaze fell on the portrait of Number One hanging on the wall, and once again he recognized the expression of knowing irony with which years ago Number One had taken leave of him.
I will give orders that you are not to be troubled until the trial, said Gletkin. Have you any other particular wish?
To sleep, said Rubashov.
Asked whether he pleaded guilty, the accused Rubashov answered yes in a clear voice. To a further question of the public prosecutor as to whether the accused has acted as an agent of the counter-revolution, he again answered yes.
The porter Vasily's daughter had spread the newspaper on the table and was following the lines with her finger.
The court then proceeded to the reading of the accusation.
Vasily was lying on the bed with his face turned to the wall. Vera Vasilyevna never quite knew whether the old man listened to her reading or slept.
In answer to a question of the president of the court, the accused answered that he had made his confession of his own free will in sincere repentance for his counter-revolutionary crimes.
The porter Vasily did not move. Above the bed, directly over his head, hung the portrait of Number One. Next to it, a rusty nail stuck out of the wall. Until a short time ago, the photograph of Rubashov as partisan commander had hung there.
Vasily's hand felt automatically for the hole in his mattress in which he used to hide his greasy Bible from his daughter. But shortly after Rubashov's arrest, the daughter had found it and thrown it away for educational reasons. At the prosecutor's request, the accused Rubashov now proceeded to describe his evolution from an opponent of the party line to a counter-revolutionary and traitor to the fatherland. He began his statement as follows. Citizen judges, my story will demonstrate to you how the slightest deflection from the line of the party must inevitably end in counter-revolutionary banditry. The necessary result of our oppositional struggle was that we were pushed further and further down into the morass. I will describe to you my fall, that it may be a warning to those who, in this decisive hour, still waver and have hidden doubts in the leadership of the party and the rightness of the party line.
The porter Vasily lay on his back and thought of the time when Rubashov had been conducted in triumph through the meetings after his rescue from the foreigners, and of how he had stood leaning on his crutches up on the platform under the red flags and decorations
and smiling had rubbed his glasses on his sleeve while the cheering and shouting never ceased. And the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole band, and they clothed him with purple, and they smote him on the head with a reed, and did spit upon him, and bowing their knees, worshipped him.
"What are you mumbling to yourself?" asked the daughter.
"Never mind," said old Vasily, and turned to the wall.
The daughter had interrupted her reading and put the primus stove on the table to prepare tea.
"So now you see," said Vera Vasilyevna, pumping petrol into the hissing apparatus. "He says himself that he is a traitor. If it weren't true, he wouldn't say so himself. In the meeting at our factory, we've already carried a resolution which all have to sign."
"A lot you understand about it," said the old man.
Vera Vasilyevna threw him a quick glance. Each time she gave him that peculiar glance, Vasily was reminded that Vera Vasilyevna wanted to have the porter's lodge for herself. 3 weeks ago, she and a junior mechanic at her factory had put their names down together in the marriage register, but the pair had no home. The boy shared a room with two colleagues, and nowadays it often was many years before one was assigned a flat by the housing trust.
"The cell secretary read us the resolution," she said. "In it is written that we demand that the traitors be mercilessly exterminated. Whoever shows pity to them is himself a traitor and must be denounced," she explained. "We have each received a copy of the resolution in order to collect signatures for it."
Vera Vasilyevna took a sheet of paper out of her blouse and flattened it out on the table. Vasily turned his head quickly away.
"And he said, 'I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me.'"
The water in the kettle began to hum. Vasily said,
"Must they also sign who were in the civil war?"
The daughter stood bent over the kettle.
"Nobody has to. In the factory they know, of course, that he lived in this house. The cell secretary asked me after the meeting whether you two were friends until the end."
Vasily sat up on the mattress.
"Give me that damned paper."
The daughter passed it to him. "Shall I read it to you, so you know exactly what is in it?"
"No," said the old man, writing his name on it. "I don't want to know. Now give me some tea."
After they had drunk their tea, the daughter went on reading from the newspaper. The trial of the accused Rubashov and Kiefer was nearing its end. The debate on the charge of the planned assassination of the leader of the party had released storms of indignation amongst the audience. Then the accused were allowed to say their last words. Kiefer turned to the judges and begged that, in consideration of his youth, his life be spared. He admitted once again the baseness of his crime and tried to attribute the whole responsibility for it to the instigator, Rubashov. Then Rubashov was allowed to speak. "Citizen President, I speak here for the last time in my life. The opposition is beaten and destroyed. If I ask myself today, for what am I dying? I am confronted by an absolute nothingness. One would be dying for nothing if one died without having repented and unreconciled with the party and the movement. Therefore, on the threshold of my last hour, I bend my knees to the country, to the masses, and to the whole people. Woe unto the defeated whom history treads into dust. I have only one justification before you, citizen judges, that I did not make it easy for myself. Vanity
and the last remains of pride whispered to me, "Die in silence. Say nothing. Or die with a noble gesture, with a moving swan song on your lips. Pour out your heart and challenge your accusers." That would have been easier for the old rebel. But I overcame the temptation. With that, my task is ended. I have paid. My account with history is settled. After a short deliberation, the president read the sentence. The Council of the Supreme Revolutionary Court of Justice sentenced the accused in every case to the maximum penalty, death by shooting and the confiscation of all their personal property. The old man Vasily stared at the rusty hook above his head, and he murmured, "Thy will be done. Amen." And turned to the wall. Rubashov wandered across his cell, 6½ steps to the window, 6½ steps back. He knew now that nothing could disturb his peace anymore. Looking back, he could even remember the moment when this blessed quietness had sunk over him. It had been at the trial before he had started his last speech. He had believed that he had burned out the last vestiges of egotism and vanity from his consciousness. But in that moment, when his eyes had searched the faces of the audience and found only indifference and derision, he had been for the last time carried away by his hunger for a bone of pity. Freezing, he had wanted to warm himself by his own words. The temptation had gripped him to talk of his past, to rear up just once and tear the net in which Ivanov and Gletkin had entangled him. But the temptation had only lasted a moment. Then, when he started to pronounce his final speech, the bell of silence had sunk down over him. He had recognized that it was too late. Too late for all of them. When the hour came to make their last appearance before the world, none of them could turn the dock into the rostrum. None of them could unveil the truth to the world and hurl back the accusation at his judges. Rubashov broke off his pacing and listened. The sound of muffled drumming came down the corridor. The drumming sounded as though it had been brought from the far distance by the wind. It was coming closer. Rubashov did not stir. His legs on the tiles were no longer subject to his will. He felt the earth's force of gravity slowly mounting in them. He breathed deeply and lit a cigarette. He heard a ticking in the wall next to the bunk. "They are fetching Herr Lipp. He sends you his greetings." The heaviness vanished from his legs. He went to the door and started to beat against it quickly and rhythmically with the flat of both hands. He drummed and pressed his eye to the spy hole. In the corridor, the dim electric light was burning as always. The drumming swelled. Steps approached, slow and dragging. Suddenly, Herr Lipp was standing in the spy hole's range of vision. His hands in handcuffs hung down behind his back. He could not see Rubashov's eye behind the Judas and looked at the door with blind, searching pupils. Then an order was spoken and Herr Lipp obediently turned to go. Behind him came the giant in uniform with his revolver belt. They disappeared from Rubashov's field of vision. The drumming faded also. All was quiet again. From the wall next to the bunk came the sound of ticking. He behaved quite well. Since the day when Rubashov had informed number 402 of his capitulation, they had not spoken to each other. Now 402 went on. "You still have about 10 minutes. How do you feel?" Rubashov sat down on the bunk and tapped back. "I wish it were over already." "You won't show the white feather," tapped 402. "We know you're the devil of a fellow." He paused, then quickly. "Do you still remember? Breasts like champagne glasses. Ha, ha,
Ha! The devil of a fellow.
Rubashov listened for a sound in the corridor. Nothing. 402 seemed to guess his thoughts, for he at once tapped again.
Don't listen. I will tell you in time when they are coming. What would you do if you were pardoned?
Rubashov tapped. Study astronomy.
Ha, 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 expressed 402. I too, perhaps. People say other stars are also perhaps inhabited. Permit me to give you some advice.
Certainly, answered Rubashov.
Empty your bladder. Is always better in such cases. Ha, ha, ha.
Rubashov smiled and went obediently to the bucket. Then he sat down again on the bunk and tapped. Thanks. Excellent idea. And what are your prospects? 402 tapped back.
18 years more.
Not quite. Only 6,530 days, he paused. Then he added,
I envy you, really. Another pause. Think of it. Another 6,530 nights without a woman.
And then, loud and hurriedly, they're coming. Rubashov stood up, then tapped.
You helped me a lot. Thanks.
The key ground in the lock. The door flew open. Outside stood the giant in uniform and a civilian. The civilian called Rubashov by name and reeled off a text from a document. While they twisted his arms behind his back and put on the handcuffs, he heard 402 tapping. I envy you. Farewell. In the corridor outside, the drumming had started again. It accompanied them till they reached the barber's room. Rubashov knew that from behind each iron door, an eye was looking at him through the spy hole, but he turned his head neither to the left nor to the right. The handcuffs cut into his wrists. The cellar steps came in sight. Rubashov slowed down his pace. The civilian stopped at the top of the steps. He was small and had protuberant eyes. He asked,
Have you a final wish?
None, said Rubashov. The stairs were narrow and badly lit. Rubashov had to be careful not to stumble, as he could not hold onto the stair rail. The drumming had ceased. He heard the man in uniform descending 3 steps behind him. The stairs turned in a spiral. Rubashov bent forward to see better. His pince-nez detached itself from his face and fell to the ground 2 steps below him. Splintering, it rebounded lower down and remained lying on the bottom step. Rubashov stopped a second, hesitatingly. Then he felt his way down the rest of the steps. He was now nearly blind, but he had solid ground under his feet again. A long corridor received him. Its walls were blurred, and he could not see the end of it. The man in uniform kept always 3 steps behind him. Rubashov felt his gaze in the back of his neck, but did not turn his head. Cautiously, he put 1 foot before the other. It seemed to him that they had been walking along this corridor for several minutes already. Still nothing happened. Probably he would hear when the man in uniform took the revolver out of its case. Rubashov tried to think of something else, but had to concentrate his whole attention to prevent himself from turning his head. Strange that his toothache had ceased in the minute when that blessed silence had closed round him during the trial. Perhaps the abscess had opened just in that minute. What had he said to them? I bow my knees before the country, before the masses, before the whole people. And what then? What happened to these masses, to this people? For 40 years it had been driven through the desert with threats and promises, with imaginary terrors and imaginary rewards. But where was the promised land? Did there really exist
any such goal for this wandering mankind? Moses had not been allowed to enter the land of promise either. But he had been allowed to see it from the top of the mountain, spread at his feet. He, Nicholas Salmanovich Rubashov, had not been taken to the top of a mountain. And wherever his eye looked, he saw nothing but desert and the darkness of night.
A dull blow struck the back of his head. He felt his knees give way and his body whirl round in a half turn. How theatrical, he thought as he fell. And yet I feel nothing. He lay crumpled on the ground with his cheek on the cool flagstones. It got dark. The sea carried him rocking on its nocturnal surface. Memories passed through him like streaks of mist over the water. A shapeless figure bent over him. He smelt the fresh leather of the revolver belt. A second smashing blow hit him on the ear. Then all became quiet. There was the sea again, with its sounds. A wave slowly lifted him up. It came from afar and traveled sedately on, a shrug of eternity.